on my 16th birthday. Instead, I consider what might help me if the testing is more than paper and pencil examinations. After several minutes, I slide off the bed and pull a small pocket hunting knife out of my chest. Each of my brothers has a similar knife, a gift from Dad. The knife also has a screwdriver and a few other gadgets attached. That's one. Now for number two. There is only one other thing I can think of that might help, but it doesn't belong to me, and Zine isn't here to ask permission. Last year, Dad began letting Zine experiment at work with his own projects. Some of those projects take him outside the colony boundaries. The boundaries were designed not so much to keep people or animals out, but to remind five colony citizens that the land beyond is potentially unsafe. Poisonous plants and meat-seeking animals are only part of the danger. During the last three stages of war, violent earthquakes ripped the fabric of the land. A lone traveler who falls into one of the earthquake-made fissures can easily find death waiting at the bottom from a broken neck, exposure, or hunger. To prevent the latter two, Dad gave Zine a small handheld device called a transit communicator, sent to him by the Commonwealth government. The device has a compass, a calculator, and a communication system that allows Zine to contact a matching device in Dad's office, if ever there is a problem. I don't know how it works, but I'm betting if necessary I can figure it out. When Zine isn't working beyond the border, he keeps the device on a shelf next to his bed. Sure enough, my heart aches as my fingers close over the device. I wish Zine were here to give me permission, to tell me he forgives me for being chosen when he was not. I wanted to tell Zine that our father was trying to protect him when the announcement about the potato was made yesterday. That it wasn't motivated by ego, but by love. I wrap the transit communicator in a pair of socks to keep it safe and slide it into my bag, hoping Zine returns in time for me to tell him I've taken a piece of him with me to Tosu City, even though I know he will not. Zine is the smartest of my brothers, but he is also the most emotional. While Win, Hart, and Hameen are loving and kind, they possess a carefree attitude about life that frustrates our mother. Zine, however, is fiercely passionate. His temper is quick to flare, but his love is all-encompassing, which makes the loss of one he loves almost unbearable. He barely spoke for a month when our grandfather died. Sitting on Zine's bed, I write a note that will serve as a request for his device and a reminder of my love. Not the farewell I hope for, but the only one I am certain I will have. Now that my selections are made, panic sets in. Tomorrow I will be walking away from everything I know into something strange and potentially dangerous. What I want most in the world is to climb into bed and pull the covers over my head. Instead, I snap the bag shut, sling it onto my shoulder, and walk back out to my family, hoping to enjoy the last hours I have left with them. Chapter 4. My brothers are still sleeping in their room when my father wakes me from a fitful sleep. I slip on a pair of tan leggings and a light blue cap-sleeve tunic, pull on my boots, and grab my bag. My mother holds a cup of milk for me to drink. Her eyes are red, but she isn't crying now. She tells me she's proud of me. I do my best not to cling to her as we hug goodbye. Suddenly, I am sorry for all the times I was angry at her for not encouraging my dreams of attending the university. Now I understand why she was scared for me to succeed. Now it is too late. Fighting back tears, I drink my milk, take the apple Mom has waiting for me on the counter, and promise to write when I get to the city. My father waits at the door, and I give my mother one last hug before walking out into the moist morning air. The sky is still dark as we follow the same path we took yesterday. We walk about a mile before Dad breaks the silence.
Did you get any sleep?
Some, interspersed with anxious dreams.
More than likely, Flint is right. The dreams are just dreams.
I hope so.
So do I.
He laces his fingers through mine as we trek uphill.
You're smart. You're strong. I have every faith you'll pass whatever test they give you. Just don't let the other candidates psych you out. Some of the kids from my colony were vicious. They'd do anything to be number one.
Like what? Staying up all night to study was common in my class. I'd done it a few times myself.
Poison was a favorite tactic of a couple of the girls in my class.
I stop walking.
Poison? Not enough to kill, just enough to make someone too sick to sit for a test. By my final year, I was careful to eat only what I brought with me to school.
Were they punished? My father gives me a sad smile.
They were smart enough not to get caught. But even if they had been, I doubt they would have gotten more than a reprimand. It's hard to punish kids for trying to pull their family out of poverty.
We walk the next few miles without talking, as I consider the implications of my father's words. I can tell myself there's no proof my father's dreams are real, but this... I can't think of a single student in the Five Lakes Colony School who would sabotage a fellow student in order to get a better grade. None of us are rich, but no one I know is starving either. Not anymore. If a family is struggling in Five Lakes, the rest of the community pitches in to help. A world where you might poison the competition in order to feed your family is inconceivable to me. Slashes of pink and purple light the sky as we approach the outskirts of town. Dad puts his arm around my shoulders and holds me close.
Make sure you eat right and get enough sleep. That's going to help you stay strong and think clearly.
I nod at the familiar words. Just before we finish climbing the last hill, he adds,
"Be careful who you trust, Sia. You do that and everything will be okay."
Hand in hand, we walk into the square. In front of the magistrate's house is an enormous black skimmer with the seal of the Commonwealth stamped on the side. Tomas Malachi and members of their families are standing near the back of it. Malachi is wearing his best clothes, stiffly pressed pants, polished black shoes, and a jacket over a collared shirt. The bright white of Malachi's shirt is in vivid contrast with his dark skin, and from the hunch of his shoulders, I can tell he is fighting back tears. Tomas's clothing choice is more like mine. Faded gray pants and a white V-neck shirt make Tomas look like he is preparing to work on his father's farm instead of traveling to Tosu City. His handsome face is unreadable as his mother fusses over his unruly hair. Magistrate Owens and the Tosu official are standing near the front of the skimmer and wave as Dad and I approach. Today, official Michael Galen is wearing a fitted purple jumpsuit, also stamped with the Commonwealth logo. His shaggy hair is slicked back into a ponytail, giving the angles of his face more definition. Magistrate Owens pulls my father to the side, leaving me alone with Official Galen. He smiles at me, and I'm surprised to see warmth for the first time in his deep green eyes.
Are you nervous about the trip, Malencia?
For some reason I don't expect him to remember my name. That he does pleases me. I'm more nervous that I'll disappoint the colony by not doing well on the tests, Mr. Galen. He laughs.
Call me Michael. And don't worry. That'll pass.
My nerves, or caring about the colony, I don't get the chance to ask because he pushes off the vehicle and holds out his hand.
Can I stow your bag? You won't need it until we get to Tosu City.
In his other hand is a transparent bag containing two thick silver bands, one larger than the other.
This is your identification bracelet. Each testing candidate is assigned an identifying symbol that is engraved on the bracelet. You'll wear this one, and the smaller band will wrap around the strap on your bag. That way, no one can confuse their bag with yours.
He snaps the clasp of the identification band onto my left wrist and affixes the other to my bag. Once he disappears into the skimmer, I study the bracelet. It is about an inch wide and woven of thick metal segments. I know the bracelet has a clasp, but the fastening is impossible to distinguish. Turning my wrist, I study the large silver disc attached to the top of the bracelet. Etched in black on the disc is an eight-pointed star. In the center of the star is a stylized lightning bolt.
The star represents your testing group.
I jump at Michael's voice. I hadn't realized he'd returned.
You'll find other kids with the same symbol on their bracelet, but yours will be the only one with a lightning bolt.
Do the symbols mean something specific? The words slip past my lips before I can take them back. Maybe kids from other colonies who always have testing candidates know what the symbols mean. If he thinks the question is silly, Michael doesn't show it.
The eight-pointed star is the symbol for rejuvenation. The kids in that group show aptitude in a lot of different areas. It's a pretty good group to be in.
His smile is warm and encouraging, and I find myself smiling back and wondering what group he was in. A small beeping sound prompts Michael to look down at his watch. He looks around the square and his smile fades. Xandri still isn't here, and I wonder if this is just her casual attention to time or if she has chosen to challenge the laws and refuse her place at the testing. Does she believe laws so long untested will not be enforced? Michael excuses himself and huddles with Magistrate Owens and my father. From the way Michael is pointing to his watch, he believes the time for Xandri to arrive has come and gone. My father and Magistrate Owens argue with Michael over giving Xandri more time. I turn away and hold my breath, knowing what the punishment might be. And I see her. I squint into the sunlight to be certain before yelling, "She's here!"
"Thank God," I hear someone whisper.
The wind teases Xandri's gauzy, multicolored skirt and peasant blouse as she strolls unhurried through the square. Her long blonde hair glistens in the sunlight. A small smile tugs at her lips as she reaches us. She offers no apologies, and I know she's planned this entrance. She's showing that while she can be required to perform, she cannot be controlled. While I admire her guts, the annoyed look in Michael's eyes makes me worry for her. My father puts his arm around me as Michael gives Xandri her identification bracelets and stows her bag in the skimmer. Gone is his warm manner as he instructs us all to get into the vehicle. It is time to go. The swirl of emotions I've been holding at bay hits me full force as my father pulls me into a tight embrace. Tears threaten to choke me as I tell him I love him. I push aside the hurt that Zine didn't say goodbye and ask my father to give Zine my note and the entire family my love. My father tells me he loves me too and reminds me in one last whisper,
"Sia, trust no one."
I am the last one to climb into the sleek skimmer. The door closes behind me. I hear the locks engage as the engine roars to life. My father puts his hand on the porthole glass, and I lift mine to mirror it. Our eyes meet for a moment, and one tear escapes my resolve as the skimmer begins to rise. Dad steps back from the skimmer, and a moment later we are moving forward, out of the square, toward Tosu City, away from anything familiar. My heart races with excitement, even as it is torn in two. I can see the same conflicting emotions on the faces of the other Five Lakes testing candidates. Our graduation ceremony changed our status from adolescent to adult, but this journey makes it official. We are on our own. I stare out the window until the last familiar sights fade into the horizon. I store up the memories of the fields and the hills for the days and maybe years to come. Then I turn and take in my new surroundings. My father and his staff have a couple of skimmers they use for work, so I've ridden in one before. But my father's vehicles are not as sophisticated or as fast as this. In fact, aside from the name and the fact that they hover several feet over the earth, the vehicles are nothing alike. Where the greenhouse skimmers are small and seat between one and four people, and only that if you squeeze, this one could seat 12 passengers in comfort. The couch-like seats that line the front of the passenger compartment are gray and soft. In the back of the vehicle is a small kitchen and a door that leads to another compartment. The roof of the skimmer is tall enough that I can walk around the cabin with room to spare. I don't see our bags and consider asking Michael where he stowed them, but he is seated in a separate driver's compartment up front. From the set of his shoulders, I'd say he's busy concentrating on driving, which is good. While skimmers are designed to hover up to 15 feet above the ground, the propulsion mechanism that makes the vehicle run requires there actually be ground somewhere underneath. If a skimmer travels over a large hole, it will stop gliding. Skimmers also have trouble over water, which is why someone adapted them to float if necessary.
"I've never ridden in anything like this before," Malachi says from across the cabin. His wide eyes are filled with anxiety. His father is an irrigation worker. His mother makes quilts. No, Malachi never would have had cause to ride on anything more sophisticated than a bicycle. Until now. I cock my head to the side to get a better view of the symbol on his bracelet. A triangle with an arrow in the middle. We are not in the same group.
"I think it's safe to say none of us have ridden in anything quite like this."
Tomas gets up from his seat in the back and crosses over to sit next to Malachi.
"At the rate we're going, we'll be in Tosu City before dark."
"You think so?"
Some of the fear fades from Malachi's eyes.
"Do you think they'll let us look around the city?"
"Probably not until after we're done with testing. It sounds like they're going to have us on a pretty tight schedule."
Tomas flashes a smile and claps Malachi on the back.
"But once we're university students, we'll have the run of the place. And the girls, right?"
Malachi smiles back.
"Right."
"Some of us don't find university pedigrees attractive." Zandri tosses her blonde mane and gives them both a look of disgust. Malachi shrinks back into the cushions. Tomas just laughs. After a bit of encouragement, he gets Malachi to talk about pictures they've seen of Tosu City, where some buildings are more than 10 stories high. Eventually, Zandri stops sulking and discusses the sculptures she's hoping to see. I listen to the three of them chat, not surprised that it is Tomas who puts everyone at ease. As always, I'm very aware of being the youngest and the least experienced. In class, I made sure to raise my hand only if I was certain of the answer, so I would never look as though I didn't belong. Now, like in class, I hold back and listen. Tall, blonde, and beautiful, Zandri exudes a prickly confidence, but her defensive posture softens when she talks art with Malachi. I'm surprised at the extent of his knowledge of artists long dead. Now that Malachi and Zandri are filling the silence, Tomas sits back and only adds the occasional comment. He too is observing, weighing their laughter and their silences. Tomas notices me watching. Quickly, I look away as my cheeks burn. Not that Tomas isn't used to being looked at. Most girls in our class would spend the entire school day watching him instead of the blackboard. Since his assigned seat was directly behind mine, I never had the distraction. But I'd have to be blind not to notice the way laughter and the single dimple in his left cheek transform his angular face. More than once, my fingers have itched to brush back the lock of hair that always falls across his forehead. Not that I'd ever have the courage to try, which is okay. Boys and dating haven't been on my priority list, and they certainly can't be now. The trio across the way laughs at something. Shrugging off feelings of being left out, I smile at the group and try to look interested in their chatter. After a while, Zandri and Malachi admit they didn't sleep well the night before. They stretch out on the cushioned benches in the front of the passenger compartment and are out almost immediately.
"Let's move to the back so we don't disturb them," Tomas whispers.
My heart skips a little as I follow his lead. Tomas's first order of business is to explore the back of the cabin. I'm happy to open cabinet doors, which contain nuts, dried fruit, cheese, and crackers, and poke into the closet, which turns out to be a bathroom. We grab a bag of dried fruit and some water and stretch out in the back. Tomas turns an apple chip over in his strong, calloused hands and says,
"It's hard to believe they selected four of us this year."
I notice his bracelet design, an eight-pointed star with three wavy horizontal lines. My group. My surprise and worry must show because Tomas asks what's wrong. I explain about the identification symbols. Then, since Malachi and Zandri are both snoring, I decide to be completely honest. "You're going to blow everyone in our group away, me included."
"Are you kidding?"
Tomas's clear gray eyes sweep over my face. After a minute, he laughs and shakes his head.
"You really aren't joking."
"Everyone knows you were first in our class."
"Only because the teacher wasn't around last year. She doesn't know you built the wind and solar generators we use at school."
"My brothers helped." The achievement wasn't mine alone. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. "My father says the irrigation system you designed is going to help revitalize areas outside our borders. That's huge." He shrugs.
"My father had been working on it for years. I just helped brainstorm a few ideas and set the thing up. I'm not saying I wasn't important, but I wasn't the genius Ms. Jorgen made me out to be. I got the impression she thought Five Lakes students were simple-minded, you know, since no one had been chosen for the testing in years. My report on the new irrigation system during the first week of class made an impression."
Tomas is right about our teacher's preconceived ideas of Five Lakes Colony. For the first few days of the new school year, every word she spoke was slow and deliberate. She sounded like she was talking to a group of four-year-olds. Then she gave us a "How I Spent My Break" assignment, and everything changed. Ms. Jorgen's face never showed surprise, but the assignments got harder, and she stopped talking in one-syllable words. Thinking about it now makes me wonder if my dad was right, if our old teacher misdirected the Commonwealth into thinking we weren't bright enough to be leaders. And if so, why would she do such a thing? Because she hated to see families separated? Or because she truly believed something sinister would be lurking for us on the other end of our journey?
"What's wrong?"
I blink.
"What do you mean?"
His raised eyebrow says my innocent act isn't fooling him. So I ask, "Don't you think it's strange that Five Lakes didn't have a testing candidate for 10 years? He pops a raisin into his mouth and considers the question.
The only thing I can figure is the Commonwealth government must have thought our population was too small to justify removing citizens. Five Lakes has grown a lot in the past 10 years.
About 350 citizens have moved into Five Lakes in the last decade. That doesn't seem like a lot, considering other colonies have tens of thousands of citizens.
You think there's another reason?
I want to tell him what my father suspected. Share the burden. Know that another pair of eyes will be on the watch for signs of danger. But my father's parting words ring loud in my head. If it were just Tomas and me, I might ignore the warning. But we aren't alone, so instead I say, "Seems like there should be, don't you think?"
If you figure out what it is, please let me know so I can tell my brother. He's feeling put out that I made it and he never did.
I know the feeling. Zine is upset too. He smiles at me, flashing the dimple. For the next hour, we talk about our friends, our families, the things we'll miss in Five Lakes, the things we hope to accomplish if we make it to the university. I'm surprised to hear he wants to go into land revitalization like my father. I thought he would look for something more glamorous. Then again, maybe I shouldn't be surprised. Despite his good looks and outgoing personality, Tomas has always been a quiet leader. He is always happy to help a neighbor or one of the younger students, and he does it in a way that does not ask for praise or payment in return. He's someone my father would be proud to have on his team. We finish the bag of dried fruit and are both still hungry. Tomas grabs a box of crackers and starts to open them when Michael yells back,
"We're going to stop for lunch in a few minutes. You might want to wake up your friends."
No need. Michael's voice is loud enough to do it for us. As Xandri and Malachi stretch and try to get their bearings, I wonder how Michael knew Tomas had grabbed the crackers. The timing was too perfect for it to be coincidence. Tomas doesn't seem concerned. He just stows the box back in a cabinet and walks through the cabin to chat with the others. But his back had been toward the driver's compartment. He probably assumed Michael had looked back and saw him take the crackers. Only I know Michael hadn't. His head never turned. So how did he know? There, in the corner of the cabin is a round glint of glass. A camera lens? I scan the rest of the passenger cabin. There aren't any others, which makes me certain I am right. We are being watched. By Michael, or does this camera broadcast farther? Has the testing already begun? I shiver at the thought of my face being seen on some unknown television. We don't have much use for televisions in Five Lakes. The magistrate has one. So does my father's work and a few other select locations. Rarely are they used. Clearly they are not used so sparingly outside of my colony. I move to the front of the cabin, feeling the camera following my every move. Does it also hear my words? If I had a chance to inspect the camera, I'd be able to tell. But I don't dare. I decide it's safer to assume it does and stare out the window in an effort to keep my discovery secret from whoever is watching. The brown and cracked landscape we've been traveling over is transitioning to healthier, greener terrain. From several feet above, I can see the soil is also richer, blacker. The signs of revitalization. The work of another colony. I move forward in the cabin to stand behind the driver's compartment. Sure enough. Far on the horizon are buildings. Some of them are tall, much taller than those at home. I wonder what colony is ahead and realize I must have asked the question aloud when Michael answers, "That's Ames Colony. We'll stop at the outskirts and have lunch." The testing committee arranged for it to be delivered to an outpost for us. "We won't get to see the colony?" He shoots me a smile. "You'll see it someday.
Right now, the testing committee is keeping you contained, so you aren't influenced by outside sources. Now you'd better sit down so you don't fall over when I stop this thing.
I return to the passenger cabin, take a seat, and relate Michael's words to the others, all while feeling eyes watching from somewhere behind a screen. The camera and the knowledge that my movements are being restricted makes my head throb and my shoulder muscles tense. The passing of scenery slows. After a few minutes, the skimmer lowers and jolts to a stop, pitching Malachi to the floor.
"Sorry about that," Michael says, climbing from the driver's compartment. "I'm still getting the hang of landing this beast. They had to put new brakes on a couple of days ago, which makes it a little temperamental."
He holds out a hand to help Malachi scramble to his feet. Then he hits a button and the skimmer door opens. Warm air and the smell of fresh greenery beckon as Michael climbs out, followed by the rest of us. A small squat log cabin sits about 50 feet in front of us. Surrounding the building are evergreen trees, hardy bushes, and lots of tall flowering grasses. It's hard to believe dry, decayed earth is just over the horizon. Whoever cared for the land here did their job well. We follow Michael down a concrete path to the wooden building. Inside is a small kitchen equipped with a table and 5 chairs. A small bathroom sits off the kitchen. The entire space is probably 14 square feet and smells of roasting meat, garlic, and vegetables. There is also a large loaf of bread and a block of cheese sitting under a large glass dome on the counter. The air inside is chilly, and Michael warns us not to leave the windows or doors open, or we'll upset the controlled temperature. One by one, we use the bathroom and wash our hands and faces. I opt to go last and wander around the room, pretending to admire the curtains at the windows. I spot the first camera, in the light, hanging over the large wooden table. The second is in the upper right corner of the kitchen. If there are more, I can't find them. Seeing the two is enough to take the pleasure from the meal. Still, knowing my every moment is most likely being judged, I eat the stew. I smile. I do my best to laugh. Out of the corner of my eye, I catch Michael watching me with an eyebrow raised. He glances up at the camera, then back at me, and smiles. He knows that I know. I shove a large piece of bread into my mouth so I have to chew instead of talk, which gives me time to think. Michael's smile was pleased, proud, as though I had been given a difficult assignment and aced it. He wants me to know. I'm certain of it. That's why he told us about stopping for lunch when Tomas grabbed the crackers. Sure, it could be chalked up to a mistake. Michael is younger than any other TOSU officials I've seen. Still, he wouldn't have passed the testing, graduated from the university, or been given this job if he made those kinds of careless errors. Is picking up on Michael's behavior and what it implies part of the test? Or is Michael offering me an edge? Michael opens a cabinet and returns with a heaping plate of cookies. They look like the cookies my mother made for my graduation celebration. Seeing the reminder of home tugs at my heart. The others grab for the unexpected treat. I push back my chair and ask if I can take a walk. I promise I'll stay in sight. I just want to stretch my legs for a little while before getting back inside the skimmer.
I don't see why not. He glances at his watch. We have 30 minutes before we're scheduled to leave. Does anyone else want to go?
When no one hops to their feet, I snag a cookie off the table, head for the door, and step into the sunlight. The air is warm and wonderful. Better yet is the feeling of being free. No cameras, no judging, no worrying about saying or doing the wrong thing that might result in my failure. Knowing what I'm headed for, I vow to enjoy this one last moment of freedom, to store up the sweetness of it to keep me calm and steady through the weeks ahead.
I spot a grove of evergreen trees off to my right and head toward them. The tall grass brushes against my hips as I trek across the thriving ground. I enjoy the crumbly sweetness of the cookie as the trees grow closer.
Sia, wait up.
Turning, I squint into the bright sunlight and hold my hand above my eyes. I'm surprised to see how far I've come in such a short time. The building that played host to lunch is at least 100 yards away. Much closer is Tomas, who is moving fast through the tall grass. The idea of sharing my last few minutes of unobserved freedom makes me want to yell for him to turn back. And yet, these are his last uninhibited moments too, even if he doesn't know it. I cannot bring myself to take them away. I wait for him to reach me before turning to finish my trek.
Where are we going?
His question is a bit breathless.
Just to those trees.
We walk the next few minutes in silence and have a seat on the shaded, cool ground.
You'd better be careful or Xandri is going to get jealous. She has her eye on you.
I'm teasing, but there is truth behind my words. Every flip of her golden blonde hair and bat of her eyelashes is designed to make Tomas notice her. So far, he doesn't appear to be cooperating. I'm not sure how I'll feel if he does.
I'm not worried about her. I'm worried about you.
His hand brushes my arm, sending a shiver up my back.
Why?
The set of your mouth, the worry in your eyes. I know your face, Sia. I can tell when something is wrong.
I shrug and try to deflect. We just left our families and friends behind and might never see them again.
I've seen you worry about your friends and family. I've seen you stress over getting an answer to a question just right. This is different.
His hand settles over mine and gives it a gentle squeeze.
I know I wasn't your best friend back home, but you can trust me.
Can I? My heart skips a beat, and I look away from his intense gaze back at the skimmer, the cabin, where the cameras are waiting. I have known Tomas my entire life. We've worked on school projects together, played games, and even danced in each other's arms for one memorable hour at last year's graduation party. We haven't talked as much this year, my fault. More than once, Tomas has asked me to take a walk or work with him on some assignment, but I've always found a reason to say no. My brother's teasing after that party, the other girls' angry looks, my uncertainty over what those dances meant, made me take a step back. Now I have to choose whether to step back again or take a chance and reach out to him. Technically, Tomas is my competition, which should make me shut him out. Soon the others will emerge from the building. Cameras will once again be watching and capturing our every move, possibly our every word. I know that here in the shade of the trees, where I am almost positive the cameras have not followed, is the last opportunity to share my concerns without being heard. My father said to trust no one, but looking back into Tomas's serious gray eyes, I decide to ignore that advice this one time. If it is a mistake, it is my mistake. The consequences will be mine to live with.
There's a camera hidden in the skimmer. I spotted two more in the cabin. Are you sure?
I nod. A lock of hair falls over his forehead as he looks toward the skimmer.
I don't understand. Why would someone be watching us now?
Because, I say, the testing has already begun. Chapter 5. Now that I've started, the words rush out of me. My father's missing memories, his fragmented nightmares, the belief that our former teacher shared the same nightmares and used her authority to prevent Five Lakes students from being selected for the testing. I hold my breath and wait for Tomas to condemn my father's ideas, to tell me that we will be safe. This is only a test, like all the others we've taken in our lives. Instead, he says,
"It's a good thing we're in the same group. We'll be able to look out for each other."
You think my father's nightmares are real memories?
I think it's a good idea to be prepared for whatever might be coming. If they aren't real, then we won't be any worse off for keeping alert. If they are...
His fingers lace with mine, and we sit there as the unfinished words hang between us. A whistle makes us jump. Michael is waving. He's ready to leave. Tomas scrambles to his feet and helps me up. He doesn't let go of my hand as we trek back through the tall grass. Halfway to the skimmer, he stops and pulls something wrapped in a white cotton handkerchief out of his pocket. Cookies. He takes one and offers me the other.
Since we're partners.
The word makes me smile. Partners. As we have been so many times before. Every time we worked together, we scored the highest marks in the class. I find myself hoping this time will be the same. Well, partner, I say, taking the cookie, make sure you turn down any cookies offered to you by our competition, just in case. As expected, Zandri looks annoyed when she sees Tomas and me climb into the skimmer together. While Tomas might not be concerned with Zandri, it is clear by the daggers she's shooting me that she doesn't feel the same. In fact, my partnership with Tomas might have just netted me a new adversary. Perhaps not as dangerous as those who would poison my food to get ahead, but still worrisome considering the length of her fingernails. Tomas heads to the back of the skimmer to sit with the other two. A hand touches my arm as I start to join them.
Everything okay?
Michael's eyes are filled with concern. I smile and am fully aware of the camera as I say, "Everything's great. It was nice to see the revitalization work up close. My father would be impressed." He glances back toward the camera. Then he returns my smile. The concern in his face is gone, replaced by pleasure. Yes, for some reason, out of the four of us from Five Lakes Colony, Michael has decided to help me, and clearly he believes I have performed well. Telling me to take a seat, Michael climbs into the driver's compartment. Zandri is busy talking to Tomas about some party they both attended a few weeks ago as I sink into one of the couches and feel the skimmer begin to move. She fingers her bracelet, a square with a stylized flower in the middle, as she leans forward, drawing attention to the loose neckline of her blouse. I don't know if the people watching us are annoyed by Zandri's flirting, but I am. And worse, I'm certain her antics don't reflect well on her academic standing, considering her reluctance to attend in the first place. I wait for an opening and ask Zandri about the new windmill she had a hand in designing. While her primary passion is painting, Zandri has a wonderful eye for symmetry and balance that our town's architect has been happy to utilize. I'm betting her bracelet design has something to do with this skill. Zandri gives me a curious glance, probably because I was also involved in the project, but doesn't dismiss the opportunity to talk about herself. Tomas asks her questions about the windmill and pulls Malachi into talking about the things he's been working on. For the next hour, Tomas and I trade off interviewing our fellow candidates, helping them look good in front of the invisible testing committee. They are my competition, but because they are from home, I will do what I can to keep us all safe. The conversation tapers off, and I find myself fighting to keep my eyes open after such a long day.
"Why don't you get some sleep?"
Tomas slides into the seat next to me and gives me a warm smile.
"I'll wake you if anything exciting happens."
I follow his advice and stretch out on the cushions near the front of the cabin. I'm not sure how well I'll sleep, knowing Tomas might see me drool, but I close my eyes and give it a try. The last thing I hear before the real world fades is Tomas telling Xandri and Malachi to speak softly. My father talks to me in my dreams. The dad I knew before I was selected. He patiently shows me how to splice flora genes. Holds my hands while I attempt to mimic his movements. Tells me the biggest failures typically come before the biggest breakthroughs. That no matter what, I should never get discouraged. Learn from my mistakes, and all will be well.
Sia, wake up.
My father's hands shake me. No, not my father. Tomas. I am no longer home. Tomas smiles as I open my eyes.
Get up. Michael says you don't want to miss this.
Michael's right. Out the window, I can see a shimmering, impossibly clear body of water. The dimming light cannot detract from its obvious purity. The five great lakes our colony is named after have been cleansed, but not like this. Not yet. The sight takes my breath away. And then I see it. What the others are watching with shining eyes and open mouths. Up ahead, beyond the water. Silver buildings. Lights bright enough to be seen for miles and miles. These can only mean one thing. Tosu City. We're here. In school, we've been taught that 99 years ago, Tosu City was created as the first tangible sign that we as a people had survived the seven stages of war. The four stages of destruction that humans wrought on one another, and then the following three stages in which the Earth fought back. This spot was chosen because its predecessor was deemed an unimportant military target by the wagers of war. While it could not escape the corruption of the Earth or the earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods, much of the city still stood when the Earth quieted, and those left alive began to rebuild. As we move closer, the buildings seem to grow taller. How thrilling and scary it must be to view the world from the top. Some buildings aren't as tall, but the squat, perfectly cylindrical shapes constructed of steel and glass are no less impressive. Building after building after building. I cannot tell how many of them are new or which survived the wars. The buildings begin to blur together, and everywhere there are people. Walking, running, laughing, hurrying. Skimmers and bicycles crowd the streets. Old-fashioned cars and glide scooters. Most streets we pass look neat, clean, and new. Exactly what I expect from the city that serves as the center of our country's hope for the future. But as we travel, I catch a glimpse of other streets that are dirtier and in disrepair. The people walking to and from those areas look worn out and tired. Some appear hungry. Others look as though they haven't bathed in weeks, and I wonder why. From school, I know the greatest concentration of our population is here, in this city, at least 100,000 people. Until this moment, I never fully understood what that number meant. Now that I do, I am overwhelmed. I feel Tomas's hand slip into mine and hold on tight. His face is pale. His eyes are wide. I think I'm not alone in my feelings of insignificance and confusion. Michael tells us we'll go immediately to the testing facilities. No sightseeing will be allowed. But I notice he takes us past the towering Capitol building and the cold stone Department of Justice, both places Malachi expressed interest in seeing before steering the skimmer through a large arching gate. A wrought iron sign next to the arch reads, "The University of the United Commonwealth." My heart skips. We are at the university. Here I can tell the buildings are old. Red brick, white trim, a clock tower.
Some buildings made of glass, others of stone. All speak of age and of wisdom. I see a large sculpture of two hands clasping each other. In prayer? In hope? Xandri might know, but I don't want to ask her. I just want to take it all in. We pass a large stadium, and moments later the skimmer slows. It comes to a stop in front of a massive, sleek building made of black steel and black glass. The grounds around it are lush and green and filled with flowers, but they in no way soften the stark, imposing exterior. A small bronze sign in front of the entrance reads, "Testing Center." The skimmer door opens and the four of us hop out. I look up at the tall structure and then at the heavy steel front door, and my stomach clenches. I feel a large warm hand touch my shoulder. Tomas. Just knowing he is beside me helps keep the gnawing panic at bay.
Here.
Michael hands me the bag marked with my symbol.
Make sure you don't let it out of your sight.
He says this in a low, quiet voice. His gaze locks with mine. There is no smile or amusement in his eyes. He is serious. I am to keep my few possessions with me no matter what. Then the moment is gone. Michael turns back and his voice booms out. Once we get inside, you'll be assigned your sleeping quarters and your roommates. Most of the other candidates are already here, since their skimmers didn't have mechanical problems. The last few will arrive sometime tonight. He gives us a big smile and asks, "Are you ready to go inside?" There is only one acceptable answer. "Yes," we all give it. Michael nods and presses six buttons on a small keypad next to the door. There is the click. The door swings open, and we follow Michael inside. Tomas is the last to cross the threshold. The minute he does, the door swings shut behind him. The sound of locks being engaged accompanies our first glimpse of the testing center, which, to be completely honest, is kind of a letdown. The lobby area is dimly lit, white walls with a scuffed gray floor. Two gray wooden chairs are arranged in a corner to suggest a conversational gathering place. But the chairs look as though they've never been used. We don't get to use them now because Michael is leading us down a long white and gray hallway to a bank of elevators. I've never been in one, but I've read about them, studied how they work. The doors open the minute Michael presses a button, and we all step in. Whoosh. In a matter of seconds, the numbers over the doors have gone from 1 to 5. The elevator dings, and the doors slide open to reveal a large, electrically lit lobby with shiny white tile floors. The side walls are painted blue, but the back wall is all glass, giving us a view of a large room beyond, filled with tables, chairs, and people. People our age. My heart lurches. Dozens and dozens of other testing candidates. The sound of a throat clearing brings my attention to an overly large woman with long curly white hair and round gold-rimmed glasses seated behind a large wooden desk. She gives us a smile and stands. The woman begins to speak and I relax. Her voice is warm and friendly as she welcomes us to Tosu City and congratulates us on being chosen for the testing.
Most of the other candidates arrived yesterday or earlier today. Dinner is being served in the hall behind me. You can freshen up and leave your things in your rooms, or you can just go straight in.
I'd like to go straight in, I say. If I am shown to my room, I might never have the courage to come out. Xandri looks like she wants to fight about it, but Tomas agrees with me, and that settles the issue.
Michael gives me a subtle nod and leads us down the corridor, through a door, and into the large hall we saw through the glass. I don't think I'm imagining it when I hear the room go silent. All eyes dart to us, take in our faces, size us up as competition. Then the talking and eating resume. On the left side of the hall is a buffet table piled with food. Three servers stand behind the table as though ready to explain the choices. Several types of bread, apples, oranges, and grapes, a red stew made with lots of vegetables and beef, carrots and tiny onions in a light sauce, and thick steaks of some kind of fish I've never seen before. Michael tells me the fish is called salmon. There is a separate table filled with cakes and other sweets.
Grab a plate. Eat as much as you want.
As if to demonstrate, he follows his own advice. The four of us grab our own plates and make our selections. I take a roll filled with raisins and nuts, a small piece of salmon, an apple, and some of the carrots. Just what I can eat. But I can see other candidates do not follow that same rule. Many have more than one plate in front of them piled with food. Some are taking a taste of one thing, then pushing it away in favor of something better. My father taught me to respect the food we grow and the neighbors we share our food sources with. The idea of blatantly wasting what has taken years to make, grow, and thrive makes me lose my appetite. The tables closest to us are all filled with candidates. They eye us as we walk down the aisle to an empty table in the back. I put my plate down and turn in time to see a large, scruffy boy with mean eyes stick his leg out in front of Malachi. Malachi loses hold of his plate, which crashes to the ground. Were it not for Tomas's quick reflexes, Malachi would be face first in stew. Despite Malachi's dark skin, I can see embarrassment burning on his cheeks. He mumbles an apology and starts to clean up the mess, but Michael stops him.
This wasn't your fault.
His eyes flick to the scruffy boy who is busy shoving cake in his smirking mouth.
Why don't you take my plate while I find someone to clean this up?
Malachi takes the plate and slides into a chair with his eyes cast down. His shame at causing an undignified scene is almost palpable, and I find my hands curling into fists. Rage, white and hot, burns in my blood. My family is close and encourages discussion to resolve differences. But I have four older brothers. When pushed, I know how to fight. I'm ready to do so now.
Sia, your food is getting cold.
Tomas's voice reaches me through the rage. The mild words hold a warning. We are being watched. Every move counts. Save my fight for later. I feel my emotions deflate as I uncurl my hands, sit with my companions, and pick up my fork. Tomas nudges Malachi and whispers in his ear. Whatever he says knocks Malachi out of his stupor. He picks up his fork and starts shoveling in food. Michael returns with another plate and keeps a steady stream of conversation going while we eat. In the silences, I hear people from other tables talking about us, wondering what colony we are. Someone speculates we are from Five Lakes, but that gets shot down with lots of laughter. Five Lakes Colony is a joke to them. The knot of worry in my stomach grows. I finish everything but the apple. The salmon must have tasted good, but I wasn't paying attention to the flavors. Another group of six candidates arrives and takes a table in the back. They hurry to eat as the rest of our plates are cleared away by women in white jumpsuits. Then a voice begins to talk.
Welcome to Tosu City, and congratulations on being chosen for the testing.
It takes me a minute to find who is speaking, since the sound is being broadcast from speakers positioned in every corner of the room.
Through the glass window, I can see the woman who greeted us, holding a microphone in her hand.
108 of you have assembled to be tested. At most, 20 will pass through to attend the university. I wish you all luck in being one of those who will pass.
Less than a 1 in 5 chance. Voices murmur around us. Some confident and cocky. Others surprised at the number, but trying hard not to sound worried. The voice over the speaker continues.
Since everyone has arrived, tomorrow morning will mark the beginning of the testing process. In 10 minutes, you will report to your designated sleeping quarters. If you haven't been assigned a room, please ask your travel escort and he or she will get the assignment for you. I advise you to get as much rest as you can to help you in the days and weeks ahead. Good night and best of luck.
Michael presses a slip of paper with my room assignment into my hand and holds his there for several seconds longer than necessary. In his eyes, in the squeeze of his hands, I know he is wishing me luck. Then he is gone. We head out of the dining hall and split up, girls to the right, boys to the left. Xandri and I watch Malachi and Tomas disappear down the hall. Then together we look for our rooms. I'm in room 34. Xandri is in room 28. As she's about to go inside, I give her a hug. Who knows what tomorrow might hold? I want her to do well. Surprisingly, she tightens her arms around me, and we stand like that for a moment. Bonded by years of shared experiences and the fear of what is to come. When we step back from each other, she smiles.
Give him hell tomorrow, you hear?
I nod. You too. She disappears into her room, and I go in search of number 34. I find it a few doors down. Someone is moving around inside. Taking a deep breath, I turn the handle on the heavy wooden door and push.
Hi.
The room is large, filled with two big beds, two desks, and some chairs. It takes me a minute to spot the source of the wispy voice. When I do, I'm surprised to see it belongs to a tall, beautiful girl with broad shoulders and long blonde hair. She gives me a shy smile.
I'm Rhyme from Dixon Colony. I guess we're rooming together.
I nod and take several steps into the room. The door clicks shut behind me.
I'm Sia from Five Lakes.
Her lips spread into a delighted smile.
That's amazing. Everyone at dinner was talking about Five Lakes and saying how no one from there has been tested in years. They thought it meant the colony died or failed or something.
Five Lakes is still around. We're just small compared to other colonies.
Dixon is small, too.
She sits on the bed against the far wall and curls her legs up under her.
We only have about 15,000 people, so it was really exciting when 8 of us were chosen this year.
Her smile is warm, and I find myself smiling back. Taking a seat on the other bed, I say, 15,000 is big to me. 5 Lakes is just under 1,000.
How many of you are here?
4, a quarter of our class.
She asks about 5 Lakes, where we are located, what kinds of foods we grow, what kinds of animals frequent the area. From what she says about her own colony, it sounds like Dixon is about 300 miles southwest of 5 Lakes. While her colony is larger, its resources aren't as developed. Maybe with so many people, it's just harder to stretch the resources they have. Or maybe it's because a large part of their adult population works on creating batteries and electrical supplies instead of developing the land. Since Rhyme's family runs a farm, they aren't hungry, but many in the nearby town are. Rhyme says the compensation money her parents will receive is going to be used for more farming and food storage equipment. Both will add to the food resources for her family and those around them. Rhyme sounds proud to have a hand in providing those things to her community. Even though I planned on keeping my distance from candidates from outside my colony, I find myself liking her. We talk on and off for the next hour. Rhyme shows me the design on her bracelet, a triangle with a decorative-looking A in the middle. Not my group. She offers to help me unpack, but I tell her I am keeping everything in my bag. Who knows when the testing might come to an end for any of us. She smiles and agrees, although I can see two billowy dresses hanging in the closet in front of her bed. My mother would have approved of the impression Rhyme's clothes will make. We both use the small bathroom adjoining our sleeping quarters, change into our pajamas, and climb into our beds. Rhyme asks if we can keep the lights on for a while. She is sitting cross-legged, flipping through a photo album she brought from home. The tears in her eyes tug at my heart, reminding me that I, too, left my family behind. That if this was any other night, my mother would be sitting in front of the fire asking about my day. My father would brainstorm ideas with my brothers while we played cards around the kitchen table. Swallowing down the wave of homesickness, I tell Rhyme to leave the lights on as long as she wants before I curl up under the covers. She thanks me. I'm about to close my eyes when she adds, "If you get hungry, I brought some corn cakes from home. I made them myself. Help yourself." I sleep with my bag tucked in beside me. My dreams are troubled, although I can't remember them when I awake to a voice over a loudspeaker telling us that we have an hour to get dressed and eat before the first phase of testing begins. I pull on a pair of dark brown pants, an off-white tunic, and my boots. Then I fold my nightclothes and the pants and top I wore yesterday and shove them in my bag. Rhyme raises an eyebrow at my repacking, but doesn't say anything. She is wearing a flowing buttercup yellow dress and shiny white slippers. She's even added touches of lip stain and eye makeup. Across the room, I can hear her stomach growling, but I notice she doesn't touch the corn cakes. Maybe I'm paranoid, but I do a quick count. There are 9 of them. If there are still 9 after today, I'll know for certain not to trust Rhyme with my possessions or my secrets. I twist the bracelet around my wrist, then check my bag one last time and hoist it over my shoulder. Rhyme walks with me down to the dining hall, ignoring invitations from others to join them. I'm not sure why she wants to stick with me, but I'm guessing she's curious about the rest of the Five Lakes Colony candidates. From the way she was talking last night, it sounds like the other colonies have some communication with one another. Five Lakes is truly the unknown. I fill a plate with strawberries, orange melon, a roll that smells spicy and sweet, and 2 strips of crisp bacon. Rhyme kids me about nerves zapping my appetite while she piles a plate high with pancakes, waffles, eggs, sausage, and fried potatoes. We each grab a glass of milk, and I look around for my Five Lakes compatriots. They are at the same table we occupied yesterday, along with a few unfamiliar faces. I am not the only one who has picked up a passenger. Malachi and Zandri introduce us to their roommates, Boyd and Nicolette. Both have dark hair, brown eyes, and tanned skin. I'm not surprised to learn they are from the same colony to the east and south, Pine Bluff. Boyd is in Zandri's group. I can't see Nicolette's bracelet very well. Her dress has long, flimsy sleeves that keep fluttering over it. Something with a heart, I think. I slide in next to Tomas, who is the only other Five Lakes candidate with his bag in tow.
Although I noticed that at least a third of the candidates, including the two additions to our table, have theirs with them. Letting the chatter swirl around me, I take small bites of the sweet fruit and try not to think about what is coming. If what I have learned thus far isn't enough, there is nothing I can do to change that. By the time I've finished my breakfast, I've learned that Nicolette and Boyd are cousins. Their two families operate a rice farm and have been struggling with their water management system. Rice is a crop I have never eaten and know next to nothing about. Tomas is unfamiliar with it as well, but hearing them talk about irrigation issues is enough to start a lively discussion. I even have a few ideas to add to the mix that Boyd thinks are of use. We are having such an interesting conversation that I forget my anxiety until a voice announces, "Testing candidates, please report to the elevator banks where officials will direct you to your first round of tests. Best of luck." My heart swoops into my stomach, unsettling my breakfast. A hand takes mine and holds fast. I turn and look into Tomas's eyes. Is he nervous? I can't tell, but I am glad for the warmth and steadiness of his hand as I rise to my feet. Almost every girl is wearing her prettiest dress and her most polished and scuff-free shoes. I would feel out of place in my wardrobe if not for Tomas standing next to me. His black boots are worn. His cotton shirt and brown pants are faded. Regardless of what tests they throw at us, I can almost guarantee that Tomas and I will be the only comfortable ones taking them. Testing officials in dark purple and deep red jumpsuits herd us into the two elevator cars and direct us to the third floor. Tomas tightens his grip on my hand as we stand in the back of the small silver room and descend two floors. Some of the other candidates give Tomas's and my joined hands a knowing look, and I start to pull away. But Tomas won't let me. I don't know why he has singled me out for his attention and support, but a small, terrified part of me is glad for it. "Partners," he called us. A word that doesn't begin to account for the bubbles of anxiety that have nothing to do with the tests, and everything to do with the way my hand feels in his. The elevator door opens, and we are greeted by more officials. It occurs to me that they are dressed in formal colors that announce their status. They are making it clear that they are adults. They are in charge. We are directed into a large room filled with seats and a stage. The lights on the stage are bright, illuminating a gray-haired, bearded man wearing a purple jumpsuit. He holds a microphone in his hand and is clearly waiting for us all to be seated. Hands linked, Tomas and I slide into seats in the back. We look for Xandri and Malachi but don't see them. The last students sit. The testing officials from the hallway come into the room and assume standing positions in the aisles. Finally, the man up front begins to speak.
"Welcome to Tosu City. My name is Dr. Jedediah Barnes. I speak for myself and all of my colleagues when I say we are honored to have you here."
His smile and voice are warm.
"You are here because you are the best and the brightest. On your shoulders rest the hopes of everyone in the United Commonwealth. Here among you are the future leaders of our country. All leaders must be tested, which is the process that you will begin today."
People fidget in their seats. Nerves? Excitement? I admit I feel a combination of both.
The man smiles again. "The testing process consists of four parts. Over the next 2 days, you will sit for the written exams. These will test your knowledge of history, science, mathematics, and reading, as well as give us an idea of your logic and problem-solving skills. After these tests are evaluated, we will make our first cuts."
The tension in the room ratchets up a couple notches. I tighten my hold on Tomas's hand, which has to be uncomfortable for him, but he doesn't complain. Part 2.